And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3737 of the Survival Podcast. If you look at your screen, you'll see just to my right, left, depending on which side you're looking at, you'll see Ken Berry, because Ken is my guest today. That's why we're on Ken's Facebook live stream as well. Hey, Ken, man, welcome back to the Survival Podcast.
Thanks so much, Jack. It's always a pleasure to chat with you. Well, usually.
Yeah, you know, I got an email a couple months ago, a month and a half ago, I guess, and a nice lady who said, would you have Ken Berry on your show? Let me tell you all about him. And I'm like, I know that, Boomer. You don't have to explain it. Just fill out the damn form. So Ken doesn't like forms, but he's got an admin assistant now that filled out the form. Ken's been on the show many, many times. He's served as an expert council member as well, been to a bunch of our workshops. So most people in this audience know him. But Ken, for people that maybe have never seen or heard of you before because they've been hiding under a rock for the last 10 years, who and what is a Dr. Ken Berry?
So I am a family physician, board certified, licensed in Tennessee. I've been practicing family medicine for over 22 years. And I used to be a severely obese pre-diabetic doctor. And you're from Texas. I'm from Tennessee. We know that 1 + 1 has to equal 2, even if it hurts your feelings. And so I could not be a obese pre-diabetic family doctor telling people that they need to cut the sugar and lose some weight. That didn't work for me as a common sense country boy. And so I had to fix me. And in the process of fixing me, I've rediscovered the principles of a proper human diet. And now I spend my time trying to educate people all around the world, prioritizing people in America, prioritizing people in Tennessee, saying, hey, it's not your genetics that you have type 2 diabetes and fatty liver and high blood pressure and morbid obesity. It's your food. So let's fix the food and then we can fix your health.
Excellent. So we're going to talk about labs today, but I'd like to start off with maybe a different angle on the question.
Yeah.
You've spoken at my events and talked about how to get physicians to do certain labs that you request that they don't want to do. And I love the leverage point you have on it. My question, though, is more, what is the freaking problem? My wife recently has wanted to have a few things tested, not even the complex stuff we're going to talk about today or the just some nutrient levels. And her doctor, you know, didn't want to do it. You're talking like calcium level and shit. What is it with doctors in the first place when you're like, I'd like to have this blood panel done, and it doesn't cost them any money. Does it hurt their feels or something that the patient had an idea?
So it's multiple things, Jack, and I'm going to try to go through them as I think of them. First and foremost, doctors these days are basically on an assembly line. If they don't get patients in and out, they'll say you've got a 15-minute slot appointment, but that typically, if a doctor can deal with your problem and get out of the room in 3 minutes, they're very happy about that because they're already 30 minutes behind. As you know, every time you go to the doctor, you have to sit there for 30 to 60 minutes after your appointment time.
But they want you there an hour early or a half hour early.
They want you there an hour early. They'll book you a 10 or 15 minute slot, but hopefully they can get out of there in 3 to 7 minutes. That's the secret goal of every doctor. And in some cases you can be in and out in 3 minutes. Some patients prefer that. Some people don't want to dally and chat and do all the stuff. They just want to get the refill and get the hell out, which I totally understand. And so there's that. Secondly, doctors, especially doctors who own their own practice, they got to pay the bills. And basically their bills are your bills, but just add one or two zeros to the end. And so people think doctors are rich and doctors make tons of money, but just take your bills and add one or two zeros. That's their bills. So it turns out they're not so rich after all in most cases, unless there's some kind of specialized brain surgeon or something. So that's number one. They're super busy. When you come in as a motivated, energized patient who's just discovered, you know, Dr. Berry, and he said, I need to get this fasting insulin and I need to get this other stuff. They don't have time to chat like that. Okay. So they're busy. Number two is, if a doctor orders a lab test and it's not paid for by the patient's insurance company, doctors have many memories of patients calling the office and raising holy hell because you ordered some crazy test and the insurance company didn't pay for it. So they get negative feedback from many patients if they order a test that's not covered. But also, if they're steadily, daily ordering tests that the insurance company does not believe is medically necessary, they can actually get a grumpy letter from the insurance company.
Okay.
And doctors never want to get a grumpy letter from the insurance company, because that's the first step in getting kicked off of the panel of approved doctors, because they want to be a preferred provider for as many different health insurance companies as possible, right? And so if they're ordering stuff and the company's like, yeah, why are you ordering that? That can actually get you in trouble with the insurance company. So there's that to contend with. And then you bump up against the limit of the doctor's knowledge. And this, anytime you bump up against anybody's knowledge boundary, that makes them uncomfortable, as you're well aware. And that can be in any field, any specialty. But for doctors, here's how it would go. If a doctor's in the rut and they just order the standard stuff every time, every patient, same stuff, and then here comes Dorothy Spearco in saying, hey, I want you to check my glucosamine and I want you to check, this, that, and the other, the doc doesn't know what the hell those tests are. They haven't ordered that test, if ever. Maybe it's been 10 years since they ordered it, and they ordered it because some specialist told them to order it so the patient wouldn't have to drive 3 hours to go back to that specialist. And the doctor didn't know what it was. He just forwarded it to the specialist and forgot about it. So in many cases, especially primary care doctors, they don't know what all these tests are. And in many cases, if somebody's been watching my videos and read my books, they know more about these tests and why you would order them and what the results mean than the doctor they're sitting in front of. And doctors, just like any specialist who's like a knowledge specialist, right? Any kind of consultant, whether that's an attorney, accountant, if you go to an attorney's office and they're like, yeah, you can't do that. And you're like, well, actually, in this case, U.S. versus McGillicuddy, they did do that. And you've just cited case law that the attorney's not familiar with. They're not going to appreciate that at all. They're not going to like that. It's going to make them uncomfortable. Now they've got an extra homework to do to make you happy, to see if that case is actually even applicable or not. So you've got this kind of perfect storm of human nature, of the economic incentive, and then of the insurance company feedback, all together basically on this doctor's back, who's already 30 minutes behind. And here's this person saying, hey, order these extra tests. And I do want to tell everyone listening my nuclear option, but we can save that towards the end if you want to. So the magic words that will get your doctor to order any test you want to order.
It's funny you mentioned lawyers, because I know where you're going, but we'll hold on to that. You've got this new book out about blood testing, and you are a big proponent of patient self-advocacy, which is what we're 100% talking about here. Like, you can say what you want, doc, but this is my body, and I am your patient, even though I guess what I said when you were talking is because the insurance company is the customer. Right. The person paying the bill is always the customer, not the person in front of you. But how do you educate people? Like, can you talk about your new book that you co-authored with Kim Howerton, Common Sense Labs, A Practical Guide to Decoding Your Blood Work and Taking Control of Your Health? I know it said releasing August 26th. That means it's out in the wild now. Like,
it is.
What is the motivation here from your side? Because I know you're big on diet. I mean, that's what you built your whole Kenberry empire on. But yes, you've always been big on this, too. I've never seen you talk without saying, here's like five tests you need to make sure you have.
Yep.
What drove this new book?
So it started out as a booklet that I would just email people for free. And then I eventually fluffed it up and I self-published it on Amazon. And it did very well as a self-published book with lots of typos, I might add. And then Victory Belt Publishing said, hey, we want to pick this up and make a real book out of it, which I was very happy to let them do. You've written a book, Jack. And so you understand writing a book is not easy, and you can never find all the typos, no matter how many people you let proofread it. Somehow they're magic at an actual publishing house with catching all the typos. I don't know how they do it. And so here, I'll give you a scenario, Jack, and this will help you understand. So you, Jack, are not, let's pretend you're not eating a proper human diet, but I know you are. It's made you much healthier. It hasn't made you any prettier, but you are much healthier than when I first met you. Let's say that 10 years ago, you went to the doc and your wife made you go. You didn't want to go. And so you go and they're like, yeah, I guess I need some labs or something. And so the doc, you're overweight. You're obviously have metabolic syndrome. Mm-hmm. And the doc's like, okay, I'll order some labs. Go ahead.
I said, and I did. You're correct.
Yeah, exactly. And the doc said, yeah, okay, I'll order some labs. So what they order is routine labs, which is going to be probably a basic metabolic panel, which is a minor check of your kidneys, your electrolytes, and your liver. And we'll check a complete blood count that checks for anemia and other things. We'll check a urinalysis, and that can check for kidney, liver, and other things as well. And we'll check a PSA since you're over 50. And that's about it. Now, when the labs come back, the doctor notices that your blood sugar's two points above what it should be, just barely high, right? And so he just writes, okay, recheck in 12 months on the lab. Now his nurse or his medical assistant calls you back and either talks to you or leaves a message and says, the doc went over your lab work and everything looks fine. We'll see you next year. Okay. So there's the scenario. You know, you feel crummy. You got brain fog, no energy. You feel like crap, you know, and you haven't been really worried because you're not the go to the doctor type of guy. So you're just like, okay, you said everything's fine. And very often they'll use language like, we checked all your labs and everything is fine. So all and everything to a layman who's not, doesn't know anything about this, this implies that they checked every relevant lab that needed to be checked and that everything was okay. So now you've got this false sense of security for the next 12 months. Hey, I'm healthy as a horse. My doc said I was fine. Okay. Now, if your doctor had, instead of just saying, well, his blood sugar is just 1 or 2 points high, that's probably fine, I'm going to check an A1C.
Yeah.
Now your doctor finds out that your A1C is 6.4. You're severely pre-diabetic, but you have to understand, without checking the A1C, your doctor is completely blind to the fact that you have severe pre-diabetes, because very often you can have severe pre-diabetes or even type 2 diabetes and your fasting blood sugar be normal. So let's just say it was normal. It was 92, normal. And so the doc literally is blind to your pre-diabetes or your type 2 diabetes. Okay. Now, it's been proven in multiple medical studies that if your A1C is above 5.6, you are doing microscopic amounts of daily damage to the tiny arteries that feed blood to every organ of your body, from your brain to the tips of your toes. So now you're walking around in Texas with this false sense of security, and you yelled at your wife, see, I didn't even need to go to the damn doctor. He said everything was fine.
Yeah.
But you're severely pre-diabetic. You're damaging the arteries feeding your heart, your brain, your kidneys, your liver, your toes, you know, other below the belt things that you want to keep working. You had no idea, right? Now, so just adding the A1C opens up an entire new realm of metabolic health. And most doctors will not check it unless your blood sugar is your fasting blood sugar significantly high. Or if your blood sugar is so high that you're spilling glucose into your urine, which is usually a blood sugar of about 180. Now, let's go one step deeper. Let's say the doc was smart enough to check an A1C, but it was also normal. Your blood sugar was normal and your A1C was normal. But you're overweight. You've obviously, your blood pressure is high. You feel crummy. What if the doctor was smart enough to check a fasting insulin? Okay. Because by checking that A1C, your doctor can predict, Hey, Jack, you're going to have type 2 diabetes within the next 3 to 5 years if you don't change your ways. Right.
Yeah.
But so we're
going
to
try to understand you there. Cause I think I do. Okay. I think what you're saying is the person's blood sugar level averaged over 90 days is your A1C number.
That's right.
And the reason it looks normal is the person is hyperinsulinemic and they're outproducing the amount of insulin and it's holding it for now.
That's exactly right.
That is like the little tiny leaks in a dam, and you can put a couple fingers in there, but that fucker's going to blow. Is that what
that's
you're
exactly
saying?
Right. Right. Exactly right.
I read
and
that
so
okay.
By just adding the A1C, he now becomes a prognosticator. He can look into the future and say, hey, Jack, if you don't cut the carbs, you're going to have type 2 diabetes in 2 to 5 years. But there's another test that can give him a 10-year look into the future. And that, so if your fasting blood sugar is normal, you're not spilling glucose in your urine, and your A1C is normal, if he adds a fasting insulin because you're overweight and you have high blood pressure, and then it turns out, oh, gosh, look, your fasting insulin level is 27, 30, 35, 40, 45. Even though your blood sugar and A1C are normal, he now knows you are severely hyperinsulinemic, which is all those fingers in the dam that you talked about, mm-hmm. holding the blood sugar and holding the A1C down. But he now knows definitively that within the next 10 years, if Jack doesn't cut the carbs, he will become first pre-diabetic and then type 2 diabetic. And also, there's increasing medical research that shows that being hyperinsulinemic in and of itself damages your organs and your tissues and can lead to severe chronic disease. And so with just adding those two simple tests, which any insurance is going to pay for if the doctor codes it properly.
Okay.
And that's another thing that we added in the Common Sense Labs is we actually added the ICD-10 codes so that if your doctor says, well, I don't even think your insurance will pay for a fasting insulin, you can say, here, dumbass, use this code and it will pay for it. Now, again, we're back to making the doctor uncomfortable because doctors don't even understand the ICD-10 codes.
Yeah.
They just pick from this limited list to try to get stuff paid for so they can get home on time. But here you're coming with new ICD-10 codes they've never heard of. How the hell do you know even know about ICD-10? Because I don't know much about it, right? And so, again, all the things in human nature are playing into this. And very often doctors will get upset with you when you start dropping technical terms like ICD-10 codes and fasting insulin, which they haven't ever ordered in their entire medical career. But now you can see who wouldn't want to know I'm going to have type 2 diabetes within 10 years if I don't straighten up. Every patient wants to know that. And you can see immediately the power that that gives back to the patient. Regardless of what walk of life they're in, we wrote Common Sense Labs, so it's as simple to understand as the manual of your leaf blower or any other little home appliance that you might buy and have to figure out how to set up and get it to run properly. The layer of lab work that we talk about in Common Sense Labs is exactly that. Anybody that has any level of common sense can figure this out and can ask for this stuff and then also can effectively stiff arm their doctor if their doctor gives them any lip.
Gotcha. Yeah, and I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me because one thing I never understood when I made the big change in my life was I went and got all this stuff done and plenty of it because I actually worked with a chiropractor to get the tests ordered and then I paid for them out of pocket. So there was no question with any of that. But my A1C was like 0.1 away from being officially diabetic. I was right on that edge.
Yep.
Personally, I looked at that and said, this doesn't make any sense to me. I probably, regardless of what this says, am a type 2 diabetic at that point in my life. That was about 7 years ago.
Yep.
I ended up with A1C about a year later of 5.3, and you told me that was about like the top 90% of people probably in the country.
Yep.
But what I'm hearing you say is basically my pancreas was listening to Bachman-Turner Overdrive and working overtime.
Yes.
And its extra production of insulin artificially deflated the A1C number from what was really going on.
Exactly right. And so here's an extra layer. We already talked about the doctors not understanding, knowing enough to even order an A1C or a fasting insulin. But so doctors use terminology and language to try to explain very complicated medical stuff to laymen and laywomen,
yeah.
Right? So a doctor might say, if they check your A1C and your A1C is, 7, 8, 9, oh, you've got type 2 diabetes. And very often a patient will say, well, how the heck did that happen? Is it genetic or what happened?
Yeah.
Very often doctors and nurses will tell you, well, you've just burned out your pancreas. and your pancreas has just given up. It's just stopped. Okay. Now, if a patient is, so that first of all, with type 2 diabetes, that's 100% false. That's okay. Never the case. Okay. If your pancreas is truly burned out and has stopped producing insulin, you're a type 1 diabetic.
Yeah.
That's what you are. You're not a type 2 diabetic. But very often doctors will use that language to just kind of give you a blanket explanation that's really not true, but it sounds true enough that the average patient will go, oh my gosh, okay.
Yeah.
Also, it sets up the patient to understand that, oh, eventually I'm going to need to inject insulin because my pancreas is burned out. It's not making insulin anymore. But if the patient is intelligent enough and empowered enough to ask for a fasting insulin jack, all of a sudden you can go back to your doctor and say,
it can't not work because here's how much insulin I'm making, right?
You told me my pancreas was burned out, but my pancreas is like producing insulin double time.
Yeah. Yeah.
What, were you being misleading or so this forces doctors to use more correct language. You can't just tell the patient any damn thing to get them out of the office anymore because the patient now knows, no, Bubba, my pancreas is not burned out or my fasting insulin level wouldn't be 32. It would be zero or close to it. So what the hell are you talking about? And what the hell did you mean? And do I have type 1 or type 2? And then also, you and I have a mutual friend who actually developed adult onset type 1 diabetes, our buddy from New Jersey.
Yep.
And it took 8 years and a couple of conversations with me because he had type 2 diabetes with air quotes. And, yeah. But he was taking every medication under the sun and his A1C was still 9, 10, 11. And the doc's like, I don't know. I feel like you must be just living on jelly donuts. And he's like, bro, no, I'm not.
Bro was like almost full carnivore at that point. He was definitely ketogenic and that probably saved his life or at least his feet.
100%. It probably saved his toes and his kidneys and maybe his eyes. If he had been eating the American Diabetes Association diet, he would have lost flesh. From his toes, his kidneys, somewhere, something bad would have happened to him. So finally, I talked to him and I said, well, what was your fasting insulin? And he's like, what? And I'm like, that's a simple test. It costs $10. Tell your doctor to order that. So when he got back home, he had him, a doctor order that. It was 0.1.
Fuck.
So he's a type 1 diabetic and he's now gets to carry around the 8 years
of damage.
That was done to every organ in his body because his doctor was so ignorant that it didn't occur to him. Maybe I should verify. I mean, he looked like a type 2 diabetic. Absolutely. But when you take a type 2 diabetic and you put them on type 2 diabetes medicine and you tell them to clean up their diet, if their A1C doesn't respond at all, you should be curious enough as a doctor to say, wait a minute, something's not right here. I need to dig deeper. His doctor didn't know to dig deeper. He's just like, I don't know. Let's try another pill and let's see what that does. So he now, if he dies 8 years prematurely, I would opine he's got a open and shut malpractice case. But the average attorney's not going to take that case because he died 20 years later.
Yeah,
so it
yeah.
doesn't look like cut and dried malpractice, but that's 100% malpractice because he gets to now suffer from the 8 years of damage that he did not have to accumulate if he had a doctor that was worth a damn.
Now, in his case, I absolutely know he had true adult onset. There's enough data we have on that. He wasn't that overweight to be, he was heavy, but he wasn't, he wasn't as big as you or me were at our worst, right?
Exactly. But to the average doctor, he was in his early 40s. He just
late 30s.
He just looked like a new onset type 2 diabetes. That's what he looked like. Yeah. And so that's evidence of laziness. That's evidence of lack of curiosity and evidence of lack of knowledge on his doctor's part. He just assumed, and you know what they say about assuming.
Yeah, yeah. So my question I was getting to there was, like, we know in his case he was a true adult onset. Can a person who goes around with type 2 long enough effectively become type 1 because they've done so much damage the pancreas literally does shit the bed? Because I know that, first of all, you and I are in agreement that we shouldn't even use the word type 2 diabetes. Like, that's not a thing. It's just what it's called. It's really a it's a metabolic problem. It is not actually. Yeah. Diabetes is your pancreas can't make insulin.
Right.
Just explain that.
Type 2 Type 2 diabetes should be renamed carbohydrate toxicity syndrome, because that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And so it's actually quite rare to develop adult onset diabetes. So it makes sense that the doctor would have missed it the first visit or two.
Yeah.
Right. Now, that's number one. Number two is it's actually quite rare for somebody with type 2 diabetes to develop type 1 diabetes later on, LADA or MODY. It's actually quite rare. And it's from looking at the physiological mechanisms and pathways, it's never caused by just the pancreas burning out. That's just a complete made up paradigm that doesn't exist in our current reality. Type 1 diabetes is virtually always an autoimmune attack on the pancreas. You can't burn out. You actually upregulate the beta cells if your blood sugar is chronically high, and you actually have more beta cells, which are the cells in your pancreas that make insulin. So okay. It doesn't work that way at all, but that's become kind of the common vernacular. Oh, you burn out your pancreas, which is not true at all.
So we call carbohydrate toxicity syndrome type 2 diabetes, and we call a pancreas that's working overtime burnt out. When it's just on its way to being burned out, it's like a guy that's working 14 hours on swing shift and never gets any sleep. He will drop over, but right now he's actually working.
Yes, exactly. And almost always some other body organ fails before the pancreas fails. Either you have a heart attack, you have a stroke, you lose a toe or a foot, your kidneys fail. Something else almost always happens before the pancreas burns out in reality.
Gotcha. So in your new version of the book that the publisher helped with, and it seems like they brought in a co-author to flesh some things out, what's different than what you originally had in the book? And what will this
book
do? So
it's got the new edition of Common Sense Labs has four times as much information. We go into much more detail, kind of explaining what this test checks for, what the results mean. We go into a lot of detail about what's the difference between within normal limits and optimal ranges, because that's super important as well, especially when it comes to thyroid health. And that's where Kim Howerton comes in, because Kim Howerton has hypothyroidism. Okay. And she developed it when she was about 11 or 12 years old. And it was missed for the next 20 years. She went to every specialist and doctor in California. Her family is of means, so it wasn't like that they were on Medicaid. They had the money. They took her to private doctors. She was put on every antidepressant. She was put on weight loss medications, weight loss injections. She was put on everything. At one time, I think she was on five different psychiatric medications, because when you have severe hypothyroidism, it makes you depressed. It makes you anxious. It makes you completely unmotivated about anything in life that a young girl and a young teenager and a young lady should be interested in. She didn't care about any of that. She acted out in school. She acted out in her personal life because her thyroid, which is the master gland, was essentially not functioning. It took 20 years, Jack, before finally a doctor said, you know, instead of just checking the standard thyroid labs, let's check a full thyroid panel. And bingo, there you go. It was obvious that she had Hashimoto's induced hypothyroidism, and it had been missed for 20 years by some of the best doctors in California.
And correct me if I'm wrong, that is a very serious medical condition that can only be addressed through diet.
It can result in complete disability or even death. If you're hypothyroid for long enough, you can develop something called myxedema coma, and you can slip into a coma and die. Very, very serious. Also, super easy to catch if your doctor knows the correct labs to check. Now, hypothyroidism is probably at least not entirely caused by diet. This is just something she had. She probably started with Hashimoto's, which is an autoimmune condition.
Mm-hmm.
And that destroyed enough of her thyroid cells that now she effectively has a crippled thyroid for the rest of her life. The autoimmune condition probably was caused by diet. Then it caused the damage to the thyroid gland. But can you imagine, and I interviewed her on my channel a few years back, and she actually broke down into tears. Because I was asking her, I mean, don't you feel like you really lost out on your teenage years? And just imagine if you were a teenager, Jack, because you and I were full of piss and vinegar when we were teenagers. Imagine if all you felt like doing was going from the couch to the bed, to the bathroom, back to the couch. And that's literally all you had the energy to do your entire teenage career. And then even into her early 20s, she didn't feel like starting a career, going to school, finding the love of her life. She didn't feel like any of that. And so, you know, we can see the damage that was done to our friend whose doctor missed the diabetes. But you can't really see that damage that happened to Kim Howerton. She just lost out on so many adventures and stories and memories in life because she was on the couch all the time and didn't feel like doing anything. So, I some people would argue her loss was greater than our friend's loss because she lost valuable life experiences. And so that's the reason that because she and I go into the thyroid chapter in minute detail. There are so many women and a few men who are walking around right now with undiagnosed hypothyroidism or Hashimoto's thyroiditis because their doctor just checks a TSH or just checks a TSH and a T4. That's it. That's their standard. If those are both normal, your thyroid's fine. I'll see you in a year.
What has happened? Has this been all like insurance and patient pushback that's caused this shit? Because what you were alluding to very early on in the interview was something, a practice we used to call defensive medicine. Yep. And that was where doctors would just order every fucking test there ever was, including the ones they gave George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, because if I order all the tests, then I can't be sued. And that was, I'm going to say 90s into early 2000s was like standard practice. And now you're like, hey, can I check my B12 level because I'm not feeling right and I read this? No. Like, it doesn't make any sense, but is that what happened?
So part of it was defensive medicine, but defensive medicine, usually what that results in is the doctor ordering imaging studies.
Yeah.
Like a CAT scan or an MRI, because you can have a pancreatic tumor and all your labs look pretty normal. Okay. But if you check that CAT scan or MRI, then you catch the tumor, then you refer them, and then you're covered legally, right? Yeah. And so doctors didn't really order lots of lab tests defensively.
So that never worked.
That's right. They ordered imaging studies, which are much, much more expensive. And 99 times out of 100, it would come back a negative scan. The hospital made money, so they encouraged it. Mm-hmm. The doctor didn't really make any extra money, so they were just doing it purely out of defending themselves against lawsuits in case there was a hidden tumor, right? Mm. And so the patient was exposed to unnecessary radiation. The insurance company had to foot the bill, and so insurance companies really started pushing back on that. And so we got to the point where starting, I don't know, 10 years ago, they would deny the CAT scan or MRI, and then the doctor would have to call and talk to a doctor who was on staff at the insurance company. And I call those doctors prostitutes to their face, or at least on the phone, and they would say, you know this call is being recorded, right? And I would say, good, I want that on the record. I think you're a medical prostitute for working for the insurance company. Because I was not one of those doctors practicing defensive medicine. I was actually looking for a specific thing that I suspected, and then they were trying to give me kickback and pushback and just trying to save money. That's the defensive medicine basically played a part in this. And so I love it that we're talking about all this stuff because it helps the average patient listening to this go, God, doctors are really, I mean, they have a lot of stuff on their plate and on their mind that they have to juggle. And then also they're supposed to be practicing state-of-the-art care on me in addition to worrying about all this other crap.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to me, this all really has its roots in the whole, I know you get into the economics of things and all too, not in your book, but in life. 1971, man. You go back to 1971, there was about one administrator to every doctor or nurse, roughly. Yep. In fact, it was a little bit less. And since then, administrators have grown in the health industry by 3,725%, and doctors and nurses relative to population have grown by 100%, doubled. So 100% growth
exactly right.
To 3,725 freaking percent, and that is as of 2022. So I'm sure that number is even worse now.
Yeah, you should find that graphic on Twitter. See if you can find it and put it up on the screen for everybody.
I'll dig it up. I'll just, it's on W2F. happened in 1971. Go ahead. I'll get it.
Yeah, okay. So basically, doctors used to be the administrators of hospitals. Every hospital administrator was basically the old doctor who was in semi-retirement, and he took over the administration of the hospital. And that's the way it was. Was it perfect? No. But did it make good sense? Yes. And then they changed the law that you actually cannot be an MD and be the hospital administrator. You have to have your own little degree in hospital administration in order to be a hospital administrator and get your own separate license. And so then if you have basically somebody with a master's or in business administration, they don't know about medicine. They just know about business administration. So they started running the hospitals like a business. And what that's going to get you is that's going to get you lots of mid-level administrators and lots of mid-level bean counters, attorneys, accountants, and all that kind of stuff. And so you can see down at the very bottom of that, the red, that's the growth of physicians.
Yep.
Over time. And the yellow is the growth of administrators over time. Now, has this resulted in an improved practice of medicine or better healthcare outcomes in any measurable way? Hint, the answer is no. None. It has not resulted in any of that. But what it has resulted in is billions and billions of dollars being paid to hospital administrators and to large medical practice administrators. Doctors are not getting raises, okay? But those administrators are getting raises and bonuses every year. And so you wind up with this bloated healthcare system, but the quality of actual healthcare has not improved at all. In many cases, it's actually went down.
Yeah. And I mean, I was going through some of the other graphs while you were talking there. Here's this one here, right? This is childhood obesity. This is childhood obesity. Begins when? 1971.
About 1971. Yeah, so many things.
I'm not going to go there because this is a medical show, but I can go through almost every problem that we look at and agree that we have today. And it's not the problem didn't exist in 1970 back. It's that the problem was pretty level. And the inflection point, whether it's college tuition, medical care, medical costs, obesity, every single one has an inflection point within 1 to 2 years around 1971. Gee, I wonder why.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think everybody should Google WTF happened in 1971 and just do a little research. I think it'll lead you down a beneficial rabbit hole to understanding what's going on with our country right now and indeed the world. Yep, I love it.
Agreed. Let's bring it back into to what your main topic today is, though. What are the blood tests that when you go to your doctor, no matter what he or she says, you should be like, doc, I need these 6, 8, whatever it is, tests. Yep. And why should we ask for those?
Yep. And so if you have any sign or symptom of metabolic disease, so you're overweight or obese, your blood pressure is high or you have hypertension, you have acanthosis nigricans, you have skin tags, you have any kind of skin disorder that just won't seem to get better. If you have arthritis or any kind of joint condition that just won't get better, if you have any kind of gut condition that just won't seem to get better, if you have high triglycerides, if you have low HDL, if you have any of those symptoms, you need the following 5 tests checked immediately because you're probably hyperinsulinemic, which I think is prediabetes. I think that what we call prediabetes now should just be called early diabetes. And all type 2 diabetes should be called carbohydrate toxicity syndrome or carbohydrate overdose syndrome. Because then when you name it that, the solution's actually in the name. You're like, oh, carbohydrate toxicity. So I'm getting too many carbohydrates. So I maybe need to eat fewer carbohydrates. Yes, immediately you start to lose weight and get healthier. So the 5 tests are a A1C, a fasting insulin, triglycerides, HDL, and HSCRP. Those are the 5 tests. And people can go back and rewatch this if they don't have their scribbler and they can write those down. If you have any of those symptoms I just listed, you need those 5 tests at least once a year. Because at some point you're going to become hyperinsulinemic and that's your kicker right there. Okay, I'm starting to do damage. This damage is going to be permanent. I need to stop that in its tracks before I have a heart attack, stroke, lose a toe, lose kidney function, lose liver function, you know, start to develop early dementia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We could just go on and on and on.
It's funny to me, you know, I have a chiropractor who's not a real doctor, according to the medical establishment. Those tests you just ordered, there's never been a blood panel that he's ever requested ever that didn't have those on it at all times.
Perfect.
At all times. So he's not a real doctor, Ken.
It's so easy a chiropractor can do it, right? And I say that in jest. I have great friends who are chiropractors who are very good healthcare providers. Chiropractors, as long as they stay in their lane, they can provide excellent kind of narrow healthcare to their patients. I'm a big fan.
Don't go there if you need a kidney transplant, but when they do what they do well, they do. My point is more that, like, that's not even what you would expect a chiropractor to do.
Exactly.
Right.
Yep.
And totally yet a medical doctor, those are all very reasonable things to check in a patient. Right?
Absolutely. And I think doctors are slowly coming on board. And I think in large part, it's because of all the millions of people who watch my YouTube videos, and they're now going in with a list of those five tests and saying, well, now you said that I'm fine, but you didn't check these. Don't we need to check these too? Because if a doctor, here's an important thing for your listeners to understand about doctors. They're like any other professional. Yeah. If some nut job comes in and says, well, I want you to check my fasting insulin, that's exactly what you're labeled as, a nut job. Like, oh, God, whatever. Okay, if one patient says it. But what happens when the fifth patient has come in and asked for a fasting insulin? What happens when the 10th patient has come in saying, hey, you didn't check my fasting insulin, don't we need that? At some point, there's going to be a number of patients where that doctor looks around and goes, what the hell is this? Why does everybody keep asking for this? That's enough of a signal for the average doctor, any doctor of any worth whatsoever. Mm-hmm. When they get home, they're going to look that up. Fasting insulin. What is this test? They're going to ask ChatGPT, or they're going to look it up on Google. They're going to look it up somewhere. And then they're going to go, and then they're going to remember the physiology that they were actually taught in medical school, that this is actually a super important marker for pancreatic health, for pancreatic function, for metabolic function. And then now, so here's what's happened after 5 or 10 or 15 patients ask for the fasting insulin. Now that doctor goes back and does a little learning, because they used to be good students, but many doctors forget how to be a good student. They go back and do a little learning, and then, Jack, here's the part that makes my heart happy. For the rest of their medical career, every single patient they see that has any signs of metabolic disease at all, they're going to check a fasting insulin. And so they're going to catch people who have been wrongly diagnosed as type 2 when they're actually type 1. They're going to catch that immediately because they checked a fasting insulin. They're going to find people with early prediabetes because their insulin's so high. They're going to help that person years before they would have ever detected a problem. They're going to be able to say, hey, Bubba, you got to cut out the donuts and the Mountain Dew because you're hyperinsulinemic. That's the first step towards type 2 diabetes. You got to cut the junk out right now, or you're going to become a type 2 diabetic 5-10 years from now. Do you see the power that gives that doctor?
Yeah, I do. And I know that actually, once you do it once, you can never forget that you did it. And it becomes ingrained in you because you realize, okay, I saved this guy's life, or I added 10 years to his life, or I didn't have him take. So now it becomes personal and real, and now it becomes something you're going to apply kind of across the entirety of your practice. And what I said when you were talking there in the chat is, if you go back to like the genesis of the original concept of a physician, you go back into the time of the Greeks. And the word for doctor in Greek actually meant teacher. It was a different kind of teacher, but it meant teacher. If somebody was going to like cut you open, that's a surgeon. And the one that would work with you was a doctor.
Correct.
And if you're a teacher, I consider myself a teacher, but I learn from my students all the time. A teacher that does not learn from his or her students is a crappy, shitty, terrible teacher. Because no matter how smart you become, if you're teaching, I assume you're not teaching one-on-one, you're teaching a large group of people, and there is collective wisdom in the crowd.
Yes.
And if you can't harness that, you have no business telling people what to do with their fucking body.
Correct. And those same adjectives apply to a doctor who refuses to learn from his or her patients.
Correct. Correct. They should be, you should be every, you know, when somebody's impressed because this doctor's been practicing for 15, 20 years, there's a reason. It's not because they're doing shit the same way they started out. They should have learned. Well, where are you going to learn if you don't learn from your practice? Which means who's your mirror in that? Your patient.
Exactly.
It seems like we've lost that intentionally in my conspiratorial mind, that the entire apparatus has been designed to sever that connection and to compartmentalize things to the point where your doctor looks at a test and he knows that you've got a big problem, but it's the kind of problem you refer to a specialist, and he doesn't want to tell you, so I'm just going to refer it to let specialists tell him. But then you spend 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks to get in with the specialist while your condition gets worse because your doctor wouldn't do his fucking job.
Exactly. And so
it's mind-numbingly, like, infuriating.
What has happened here, Jack, is the ways in which a doctor can be a bad doctor has changed. Because in the past, before 1971, a bad doctor would just miss obvious signs or symptoms. They would just miss that because they either weren't educated or they weren't paying attention. And so when the insurance company, when their skin got in the game because they're starting to reimburse claims, they're like, hey, we can't have these because, you know, maybe 5-10% of docs are not that bright. We can't have them missing these obvious things. So the insurance company started coming up with algorithms. If this patient has this, then you must check this, this, and this. And so all the bad doctors are like, okay, I'll just follow the algorithm because I obviously didn't know that. And so now you've got all these bad doctors following the algorithm. So they're not missing those obvious signs and obvious symptoms that they used to miss being a bad doctor. But now what you get is a bad doctor that just blindly follows the algorithm and never does any independent thinking, never does any thinking outside the box. So the large, egregious misses that used to get missed by a bad doctor, they get caught now thanks to the insurance company making thousands of algorithms. And many of these algorithms are now integrated into the doctor's electronic medical record. So when they type in this patient's having belly pain and weight loss, immediately the algorithm says, do an abdominal exam. They might have a pancreatic cancer. If you feel anything, then order an abdominal CT. See, that would have got missed, and that patient would have died within 6 months. Now they can live for 2 or 3 years. And so the insurance companies, basically their accountants and their attorneys said, these idiot doctors, we're going to have to come up with algorithms. So now the bad doctors practice algorithmic medicine. And so if it's not in the algorithm, it never occurs to them because they're so dumb and lazy. They just assume that the insurance company thought of everything.
But even the good doctor ends up using that as a crutch, and hence the good doctor becomes maybe not bad, but mediocre.
Complacent and lazy, yes. And even good doctors, if they, let's just say the doctor's got a spouse that's not the best spouse in the world. They've got $300,000 in student loans from going to medical school. They don't have family support. Maybe they started taking, you know, something to get to sleep or drinking something to get to sleep at night. Now they've got a problem with that. You've got this previously very good, energetic, interested doctor who wanted to learn about stuff. Now they're leaning on the crutch of the algorithm and they stop being that good doctor. And so it's not really a problem that can be solved. This is a dilemma. There's really no good solutions. The only thing that a patient can do is educate themselves and stop thinking of their doctor as their daddy or their boss and start thinking of their doctor as a learned health consultant. Just like if you took your car to a mechanic, Jack, and it had missed a couple of times and you took it by the mechanic, he's like, oh, your motor and your transmission are both shot. I've got them in stock right now. I'm just going to replace them. You'd go, whoa, hold on a second. What? No. I'm going to take this down the street and see what they say, and then I might be back. You can do that same thing with your attorney. You can do that same thing with your accountant. You can do that same thing with your doctor. If they get offended by that, screw them. Find a new doctor, okay? Because there's many young doctors out there who are more than willing to work with you and to consider alternative hypotheses and to consider alternative diagnosis and to learn about these lab studies that every doctor should know about.
Yeah, and I just put up on the screen, honestly, get a DPC, which is a direct primary care physician. You know, then you're not using your insurance to pay for things, but you actually get things done and what's your life worth. And you know, we're in a position now where Dorothy's picked up a DPC, even though she's on Medicare because she's of age. And, yep. And, but, okay, so now the DPC will say, you need this, and she'll go to her primary care instead of her direct primary care and say, my DPC says I need this. Well, all of a sudden, well, I guess I got to do it because a doctor said it, right? Like, and it's, you know, a couple $100 a month to have someone that you can pick up the phone and call and will freaking talk to you and actually listen to you. You know, I'm going to say there's people that do that for money. They call psychics that make a hell of a lot more money than a licensed physician does doing it. So they worth the freaking money, right? And you might actually get real information that way.
And if people can afford that, I'm 100% for that. Just having a second set of MDIs on a situation very often is hugely important. That's number one. Number two is never fear asking your doctor for a second opinion. If they recommend a certain test that you don't want to have or they recommend a certain procedure, it is your right as a patient to say, hey, I'm going to get a second opinion on that. If a doctor's offended by that, that's a huge red flag. They may be a bad doctor. Okay. Because I welcome that. I'm like, oh my God, yes, please go get a second opinion. And then let me know if you still want to do this afterwards. Yeah. And 9 times out of 10, they'd come back and say, yeah, go ahead and order it. They said I needed it. But a bad doctor will be offended because they're afraid that you're going to reveal their islands of ignorance if you go see another doctor. That makes them very uncomfortable, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm all for that. I'm all for patients. If a doctor has hanging in their office a sign that says your Google search is not better than my medical degree,
yeah,
just cancel the appointment right then and walk out. Because I encourage every patient to do an internet search or have a chat GPT conversation. Within the results, it's going to say you might have cancer. Yes, that's going to be one because that's literally in the differential diagnosis of every single symptom. Yeah. A common sense person is going to say, well, it said I might have cancer, but it also said these 40 other things
that are
much more likely. So I'm going to go to my doc and I'm going to ask for these tests. If your doctor's offended because you did outside research before your appointment, that's a huge red flag.
They welcome that, right? They say they want you involved in your health and caring about your, and as soon as it's just like being a parent of a school kid. They tell you, we want parents involved. When you show up to the PTA meeting and you don't sit there and shut up and just accept what they tell you, well, then they don't want you anymore. So you never really wanted me involved. You just wanted me to obey you. That's, you know, and my thing with arrogant doctors is, if I'm going to lay down on a table, they're going to put me under and somebody's going to cut my skull open and work on my brain. I want a fucking arrogant brain surgeon. I really do. I want the guy that thinks he's God because he's probably really good at what he does and he's not going to kill me and I'm going to wake up and know my name and not piss my pants every time the microwave goes off. Right. Yep, I want that in my physician who I'm working with. I do not want arrogance. I want confidence, but I want nothing to do with an arrogant doctor.
Completely agree. So now let's talk about if somebody watched this, they're very energized, very like, man, yeah, I want to take charge of my health. I want to know what's going on. They buy Common Sense Labs. They watch some YouTube videos. They do some conversations with ChatGPT, which I highly recommend. Obviously, you would never blindly take its advice, but it will give you the differential diagnosis. Then you've got more things to look up and research and go, yeah, that doesn't sound right. Yeah, that didn't sound right. Oh, wait, that sounds very close to what I have. I'm going to go see the doctor and ask them about that. That's perfect use of ChatGPT and internet searches and reading books on your own. Mm-hmm. If your doctor doesn't welcome that, that's a huge red flag. Now, what if you're very motivated now, you've read Common Sense Labs, and you go to your doc and say, hey, I think I've got Hashimoto's thyroiditis or any of 20 other things we talk about in the book. Please check these labs. What are you going to do if your doctor says, I wouldn't even know how to interpret those labs. I'm not ordering those. Your insurance is not going to pay for those. I'm not going to order those. What do you do?
The magic words.
The magic words. And here they are. Everybody, pay attention. You can go back and watch this again. You can record this. So you say to the doctor, okay, doctor, I am very concerned about my health. I'm afraid something's bad wrong with me. I've been doing my own research and I have the following symptoms. And my research has told me that one of the possible diagnoses is this or this or this. I will be able to tease out if I have that diagnosis or not, if you will order these tests. That's why I ask you to order them. You have refused that. I need you, and this is the kicker right here. I need you to document thoroughly in my medical record, my permanent medical record, that I am worried about my health, that I asked for these tests, and that you refused to order them. Please document that in my permanent medical record in detail, and then I would like a copy of that when I leave the office today. Now, when you say that, the sphincter factor in your doctor is going to go up to about a 9 out of 10. Okay, because what you've just said is, if I have one of these conditions and I wanted these tests and you didn't order them and I wind up having that condition and I die prematurely, my family's going to sue your ass off. That's what that meant right there, because now I have documentation that I ask you for these tests and you refuse to order them. Any doctor, for two things are going to happen, Jack. Either the doc's going to become furious and kick you out of the office, which is actually a good thing, because that's a huge red flag. That doctor, you don't need that doctor in your life. Yep. Okay. Any other rational doctor is going to go, holy crap, how do they know how to phrase that like that? Okay. And they're going to get out their order pad and say, okay, what is it that you wanted? And they're going to start checking boxes and ordering the tests. And then after they do that and they order them, I want you as the patient to apologize to them. Say, I'm sorry, I had to play the kind of the nuclear option on you, but I'm really worried about my health. I like you, doc. I want you to be my doctor. I want to work with you as a partner. And I understand you're way smarter than me on medical stuff. But if I have a concern, I want you to also be concerned, or to thoroughly explain to me why I shouldn't be concerned, or to order labs that when the results come back will ease my concern. That's what I want from you as my learned health partner, not for you to just say, no, I'm not ordering that. That's not acceptable. So if you can work with me in the future, then I will apologize for doing that to you. But in the future, when I ask, I want to at least have a conversation with you. I don't want you to just tell me no like I'm your 5-year-old child.
Yeah. And I think one of the things doctors need to realize is how informed a patient really is when it's important to them. And nothing's more important to me than like not dying, assuming I'm not suicidal. Because exactly. What I've noticed over many years now is that the patient with a rare form of cancer knows more about that cancer than an oncologist, a general, maybe not an oncologist who specializes in it, but your average everyday run-of-the-mill oncologist who's a cancer doctor doesn't know about that one particular cancer the way the person does it. Or my wife for about 8 years suffered from a condition called trigeminal neuralgia, which is pressure on the fifth trigeminal nerve coming down into the jawline. Yep. I guarantee you, maybe not a neurologist, but you sit me down with any regular everyday physician and we have a discussion about trigeminal neuralgia, I know more. Why? Because yep. I watch my wife suffer from a disease that's literally called the suicide disease.
That's
so
correct.
I cared more. And if you're a doctor and you don't understand that your patient is going to go more into what's wrong with them than you ever will, then you're in denial of human nature. This isn't even about medicine. It's human nature that my own self-interest is me yep. and the people I love, and I'm going to put more time and effort in it than you, and I'm not going to trust you until you take me seriously. And if
exactly
you don't have trust
right.
between a doctor and a patient, you've got shit. You might as well have socialized medicine then, where you don't even
exactly
get to see
right.
a doctor every time you go in. It doesn't matter. It's just a doctor.
Yep. And what happens is after a doctor has that conversation once with a patient and then they actually check the labs mm-hmm. and it comes back, oh my God, they do have Hashimoto's or they do have hyperinsulinemia. That doctor learns a lesson from that patient interaction. And I tell people all the time in our private community, you understand you've not only improved your health, you have improved the health of every person in your community. who goes to see that doctor, because now that doctor is keto aware, carnivore aware, and he or she knows to check a fasting insulin if you have the following symptoms. And they're going to do that with every patient they see in your community, in your small town, in your big city. Every patient they see, they're going to order that stuff for the rest of their career. And so this guy who was a truck driver, or this woman who's a cashier at some supermarket, she's literally saved hundreds of lives in her city. People she's never met, just because she woke her doctor up and got her doctor paying attention again. It's such a powerful thing for people to be able to do that, and to know that they've had that effect on their entire community, for people who they've never met. They'll never know their name. They have saved their life because the doctor now checks the test that needs to be checked.
It's interesting too, when you have these conversations where they lead, like I've talked to doctors, not really my doctor, but doctors, about ketogenic diet. Right. And it doesn't work. And you can know all the things about why they're wrong. But what's really interesting is you go, but does it work for anything?
Right.
Throw it back at them. And most doctors will dig back into medical school somewhere and go, well, it helps with certain epileptics.
That's right.
Really? What is the mechanism by which it helps those epileptics? They don't know. They never know, because we don't know exactly why. Well, exactly. If it helps a chronic medical condition and you don't know the mechanism by which it addresses that condition, how can you say it can't help other conditions?
Correct.
Maybe you can look into that and inform my ignorant ass. Don't say it that way. But inform me, who's got this question about why it seems to work, and you said it works for this. Can you tell me why it works for that, so I can understand why it doesn't work for this?
Yes, that's a brilliant question. That's the type of informed leading question that when a patient's asked enough questions like that, a truly bad doctor will just fire you from the practice because they don't want to discuss it with you. They want you to get the hell out of there so they can make their golf tee time and make their Mercedes-Benz payment. They don't want to spend time talking to you. But a good doctor is going to go, that's a valid point. I don't remember how it works for seizure disorders. When he gets home, he looks that up and he's like, oh, it's ketones. Oh, they're in ketosis.
Yeah.
Oh, and ketosis is not the same thing as ketoacidosis. So ketones might work for other neurological conditions or psychiatric conditions if it works for seizures, right? And so then now that doctor's going down this very productive rabbit hole of going, well, yeah. And then that doctor goes to PubMed.gov and puts in ketogenic diet, and he sees that there's over 500 studies going on right now or have just been completed about a ketogenic diet for schizophrenia, for OCD, for bipolar disorder, for depression, for anxiety, for basically every psychiatric condition, and then multiple medical conditions like fatty liver, type 2 diabetes, severe obesity also respond positively to a ketogenic diet. And when that doctor discovers that, oh, a carnivore diet is a ketogenic diet, just by definition, because you're eating very low carb and high fat, you're going to have ketones. So carnivore is keto. Therefore, carnivore could also be therapeutic for all these conditions. Now you've literally changed that doctor's treatment paradigm for the rest of their career. And that's pretty darn sexy.
And, you know, this trial and error says most doctors will tell you keto is bad for you. That's what this whole discussion was just about, though. Like, if you tell them they're wrong, they won't listen to you. But if you send them on a quest, I need to understand why it works for this, but it doesn't work for that. And they don't have an answer to why it works for this.
Yep.
Even if they tell you to F off. That is like, that's one of those things you plant somebody's head. It's like one of them worms in the Star Trek movie where it starts eating at your brain and they want it to. The only way I can make it stop is to get it. When you give somebody an open-ended question that they cannot answer and it's in their wheelhouse, it might be a week later. They might be fighting it, but they're going to, damn it, I got to fight. Like, you got to know. It's like, that's why you end movies with an open ending. So somebody wants a sequel because the mind wants a conclusion. And, you know, psychology is a form of medicine, and we need to learn to use it to treat ourselves by using it on certain medical professionals, in my opinion, because if you don't take care of my wife, you're going to be lucky you're in a hospital. Works sometimes, which I had to use that once, but it doesn't work all the time. You can't always do that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
We talked about these tests that everybody should get from more of a concern standpoint. What are the labs that should be like a comprehensive annual checkup, like everybody should have them. And I'm sure they're in your book.
They are. There's a one-page list that anybody that's basically over the age of 40, if they're a little bit overweight, if they have a little bit of fatigue, if they have a little bit of brain fog, there's a routine standard set of tests that's going to check for all the most common reasons why you might be having those symptoms. And we've got the lab test list broken down by symptom. So if you're a 50-year-old woman who, you know, you're not sleeping well and you just got no get up and go, here's the list that you need to check for that. If you are gaining weight, you always feel cold and your eyebrows are starting to fall out on the outer part, here's the list of labs to ask your doctor for. And so the lab lists that we have in Common Sense Labs, that's not the end all be all, because there are even more rare diseases. Because if we made this book with every single test that you could order at a lab, this book would be 900 pages thick. Okay. So basically most doctors stop at just the base surface level labs. They don't go any deeper, primary care doctors. But what this helps you understand is what is truly the primary or first layer of labs that should be checked in pretty much anybody. And then what's the secondary layer? If all those are normal, but you're still having symptoms, here's the secondary layer of labs that you should ask your doctor for and then have a conversation about. And so if we went into the tertiary and quaternary, like I said, this book would be 1,000 pages. Okay. Because there's literally if you, and so we, also when the doctor's office calls and says, hey, we checked all the labs and everything looks good. If they truly checked all the labs, you would get a $10 million bill. From the lab company. Okay. So no doctor checks all the labs. What they mean by that is I've checked all the labs that I have decided are relevant to you as a gender, as a age, as you know, your overall physical condition. These are the labs that I think are really important for you. Those are all normal. That's what they really mean when they say we checked all the labs. They did not check all the labs. Okay. And so that's kind of what I want to do with this book is empower people to understand it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to get in between your doctor and the door and not let them leave until you've gotten your 3 questions answered or your 5 questions answered. That's actually not rude. They're being rude by trying to rush out of the room before you've had a thorough medical visit with them. Now, is it 100% the doctor's fault? No, it's all the administrators from the chart we showed early. Yelling at the doctors. Doctors not getting bonuses because they're not seeing enough patients a day. Doctors not being able to pay their bills if they own their own clinic and having to let a part-time employee go because they can't pay their salary. It's all this stuff. But at the end of the day, you, my friend, are the patient, and you are the one who has rights, and you are the one. The doctor has a fiduciary duty. That's a big word, and it means basically it's a parent-child relationship. That's how the law looks at this. If the doctor is just patting you on the head and sending you on your way and they miss something, they are legally liable for that. And doctors know that, but when you know it, it allows you to set up a little straighter and have a little more self-confidence and not be shy and say, well, actually, doc, sit down. I've got 2 more questions I want to ask you before we end this visit. And if a doctor's got any sense at all, they will sit down and shut up and listen to your questions and then answer them to the best of their ability.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about diet here. Like I said, it is kind of what you made your bones on early on, and there's a big reason for it. You know, we're talking about testing for all these conditions, and this is important because you can eat a perfect diet and have kidney cancer. I mean, like,
sure,
you need to know if something's out of whack, even if you look and feel healthy. But a lot of the things that we're testing for are lifestyle illnesses, right?
Yep.
I remember when I first discovered this, I started looking for anything on eating low carb. And I found this documentary. I don't remember what it was called. And it wasn't really about eating carnivore or keto specifically. It was about traditional diets, which end up being they typically end up being very, at least keto adjacent, at least. And there were these Australian aboriginals that they went to see, and they were, I mean, huge obesity rates, type 2, everything, metabolic syndrome, all of it. And they, but they asked this, the two, like the oldest ladies there, they looked like they were in their 80s, and this was made about 15 years ago, so you could date that back. And they said, how long you been around? They said, you know, we've been around a long time. And well, what do you remember before now what did people die of? And they died largely of communicable diseases, like polio and smallpox and stuff like that. And they said, well, what made that go away? Well, you know, vaccines. And they said, okay, in this in-between stage, when people didn't have all these chronic diseases and they weren't falling over at 15 anymore from smallpox, what did people die of? And they looked at each other and they looked around and they started talking in their native tongue. And the one old lady comes back and she goes, old age.
Exactly.
And so I think that that alone tells you that the way we eat is why we're dying younger at a time when we have been increasing life expectancy for decades. All of a sudden we're coming down the other end. And if you look at obesity rates, right, it correlates with it perfectly. Can we talk a little bit about eating a keto or carnivore diet? And I know you're all carnivore, but you're not opposed to people breaking off a piece of that and maybe eating some vegetables or stuff either. Like, you have your way, and then you think that's the best way, or you wouldn't do it, but there's other good ways.
Oh, 100%. So a proper human diet is not a single diet for everybody. It's a spectrum of diets, and it ranges anywhere from low carb with real whole one-ingredient foods to keto with real whole one-ingredient foods. I have to say that now, even though it's a mouthful, because there's keto bread and keto cake. That's marketing. That's not really keto, okay? And then there's ketovore, and then there's carnivore. And what you're doing when you move from low-carb to carnivore is you're cutting down the carbohydrate intake. That's what makes them each part of the proper human diet spectrum. I think there are some people who are young and metabolically healthy, very active. They can eat under 100 total grams a day of real whole food, plenty of meat and eggs. They're going to be perfectly healthy and live a long damn time. Some people who fatten easier or develop type 2 diabetes easier, they need to be keto. And they need to keep the carbohydrate intake, total carbs, not net carbs. That's another marketing term. They need to keep total carbohydrates somewhere between 20 and 50 total grams a day max. And if they do that, they're perfectly metabolically healthy. Their weight's good. And they live a long damn time. Some people who fatten very easily, like me, or develop type 2 diabetes very easily, need to cut the carbs even more, which is ketovore or carnivore. So under 10 total grams of carbs, or as close to 0 grams as you can get. And all of these foods need to be real, whole, one ingredient, ancestrally appropriate foods. And so that's why I came up with the mantra of beef, butter, bacon, and eggs, because all four of those foods are ancestrally appropriate. They're essentially zero carb. They're not inflammatory, although a lot of people think red meat is inflammatory. The research is very clear that it's not.
It's not only not inflammatory, it's literally anti-inflammatory.
Exactly. Exactly right. And they're also nutrient dense, and they are foods that our ancestors ate 1,000, 10,000, 50,000 years ago. So you can't come at me with any kind of common sense and say, well, red meat causes cancer. The World Health Organization said it did. You're like, you can reply with, dude, we've been eating red meat for 100,000 years, but now, it causes cancer. We wouldn't be here as a species. That's exactly right.
We would have made it.
Exactly. And so it just becomes foolishness. Basically, the plant-based vegan vegetarian belief, because that's what it is. It's a magical belief, not based on any fact, has been so popular in medicine and nutrition for so many decades that young doctors and young dietitians just believe it's self-evident. They're like, well, I mean, everybody knows that. And then you ask that leading question, like Jack talked about earlier with the ketogenic diet and epilepsy. You say, well, how do we know? Has that been proven? Has it been proven that red meat causes cancer or red meat causes heart disease? And if they truly have bought into this paradigm, they'll say yes. And then when they say that, you've got them on record saying something that's absolutely provably false.
Yeah.
Because it has never been proven that red meat causes cancer or heart disease. It's never been proven
or any of it.
Right. Even bacon. Oh, my God. The devil of all foods. The bacon, bologna, hot dogs, they've never been proven to increase your risk of cancer or to increase your risk of heart disease. That has never been proven. And so when you start saying things like that,
people will say, no, I read that. And I read this study, and it showed a correlation between meat and cancer rates. And I'm going to tell you what in that study, what was meat. Pepperoni pizza was meat. Spaghetti
That's right.
and meatballs was meat. Right.
Correct.
Right. We're just going to ignore all the other stuff going in there. And then this correlates to something. Somebody said something about how great a Mediterranean diet is. And I said, the sad thing is the term Mediterranean diet doesn't mean anything as it's used. Because
exactly.
if you tell somebody, ascribe a Mediterranean diet to me, they're going to tell you how Italian people who live in New Jersey eat. And that is not how you want to piss off an Italian. Go to Italy and ask them to make you food like you would get in New Jersey or New York City. And they will throw you straight out. You're not going to get food like you get at Macaroni Grill or Olive Garden or something like that. Here in America, you go to an Italian restaurant. What do they bring you? First thing, bread and oil. You know the first thing they put on your table in Italy? Bread and oil. You know what? Nobody does? Touches it. Nobody touches it. Then they bring out this very light sauce pasta, very heavy on meat, and people eat that, and there's a little bit of sauce in the bottom, and they dump a big glug of extra virgin, actual olive oil that came from an olive in there. They take one piece of bread per person, wipe it out, and they eat that to clean out the bowl so they don't waste the food, and that's traditional. That's
yep, absolutely.
I'm not even advocating a Mediterranean diet. I'm just saying when somebody says that and you, what comes in your head today, if I can eat a bunch of pasta and all this shit, that's not a Mediterranean diet, not traditionally. That is not
the Americanized version. That's the Chef Boyardee SpaghettiO version of a Mediterranean diet. I've actually
Catholic that moved here in late 1800s as a barber like my great-grandfather and had 14 kids and barely made any money and had to figure out how to feed them all. That's what that is.
That's exactly right. And it sounds like you've been to the Mediterranean before. Nisha and I have actually been to several countries, and we never eat at the tourist restaurants. We always go three or four streets over where they stop having pictures of food on the menu and stop having English on the menu. And we always eat at those restaurants because that's actually real Italian or real Turkish or real whatever country. Yeah. And it's always full of meat. It's always full of eggs. It's always full of cheese. There's and instead of ketchup and mustard on the table, they have salt and olive oil and vinegar. That's the condiments. If you ask for ketchup, they're like, oh, no, your restaurant back that way. You go that way if you want ketchup. We don't have that here. And so real Mediterranean diets are full of meat and full of cheese and full of seafood and full of eggs and also some olive oil. And I tell people all the time, who are eating a carnivore diet, if you don't want to have the diet discussion with your doctor, don't tell them you're carnivore. Just tell them just for the night before you go to your doctor, put a little squirt of olive oil on your steak and then tell them you're eating a Mediterranean diet because you put some olive oil on it.
Oh, man. I'm adding something to the chat here. So I said, like, if you go to the kind of place Ken's talking, you're going to get like one thin piece of toast.
Yep.
With a whole sardine on it and a couple thin shaves of like really awesome parm and,
yep.
and a drizzle of oil, and it's delicious. But the other side of that is that a sardine in Italy does not come in a can. And when I say
Correct.
Sardine, if you're thinking, and I don't even dislike those. I'm just saying if that's what you think I'm talking about, that is not. I'm talking about, you know, about a 7-inch fish, skin, gutted, bones and all. Properly prepared, sitting on that, and then you're eating collagen, you're eating bone, you're eating like the way your ancestors ate, and you're eating a Mediterranean diet. I like your steak with some olive oil on it, though. That's a Mediterranean diet.
100%. And so it's not about the pasta, it's not about the bread, it's not about the margarine. Definitely, there was butter on in every dish we ate. When we were traveling around the Mediterranean, butter in every dish. And so if anybody tells you that you should eat plant butter, margarine, any kind of vegetable oil, that is not Mediterranean. They used olive oil, yes, but butter and bacon grease and beef tallow, all the animal fats, chicken schmaltz, they used all that stuff. And that was the standard way you cooked the Mediterranean diet. The Harvard School of Public Health and the Tufts School of Nutrition and Loma Linda, California, have hijacked the term Mediterranean diet, and they've made it mean something that nobody who's a native Italian, they would not know what you're talking about if you set that down and said, is this Mediterranean? Whatever the Italian version of hell no is what they would say.
My understanding is that people from Italy hated the TV show. I think it's gone now, called Jersey Shore. Like, that was their ultimate loathing and hatred of America was when Jersey Shore came out, because it was all Italian Americans who ain't had a person that's ever been to Italy since their great great grandfather. You know, yeah. And that has really hijacked things. Like I was said in the chat there today, you mentioned margarine. You know what they call margarine today? Vegan butter.
Yeah. I call it Satan scrotal sweat. That's what I call it.
I call it an industrial lubricant because that's what it is, but I like your term better.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how, if we follow this keto, carnivore, low-carb lifestyle, how that's going to affect a lot of these blood tests that we've been talking about today? What you're going to see, let's say that you don't have cancer of the medulla oblongata or something like that. You just have lifestyle illness problems. What does it look like for a person, let's say they go full on, maybe not carnivore, but at least like serious keto, they're like 25 carbs or less a day, and they're doing it right, maybe they're in two meals a day. What does it look like 30, 60, 180 days out?
So let's say somebody with type 2 diabetes starts either a meat-heavy keto with real whole foods, not keto bread, let's say their A1C is 10 right now, and they're on three different medications and they're injecting insulin. When they start a real ketogenic diet, they can stop the insulin immediately. They no longer need it. And they'll have to once every 2 weeks or once a month, they'll have to stop another one of the type 2 diabetic medications, or their blood sugar will start to go too low very, very quickly. So in 3 months' time, when they go back for their A1C recheck, their A1C is going to go from 10 to 7.1. Three more months, it's going to be 5.9. Three more months, it's going to be normal. They will completely reverse type 2 diabetes within 6 to 12 months on either real meat-heavy keto, ketovore, or carnivore. If they had hyperinsulinemia, their insulin level was 30, 35, 40, within a month, that's going to be back down in the high teens, maybe 17, 18, 19. Another month, it's going to be down to 12, 13, 14. 3 months later, it's going to be back close to normal, which is under 10. If you have somebody with severe obesity and they do real meat-heavy keto or carnivore, they're going to start to lose 20 pounds sometimes within the first month. Now, most of that's fluid weight. That's true. But it's not healthy to be carrying 15 pounds of fluid on your body that you don't need. So that's actually a good thing as well. But they're going to lose – we've had people lose 40 pounds in 3 months. They lose 80 pounds in 6 months, because when your insulin level comes back down to normal, that basically opens the floodgates for you to burn off the stored fat that you don't need anymore. But every time you eat carbs, especially ultra-processed sugar-added carbs, that's going to spike your insulin, and that completely turns off your body's ability to metabolize and get rid of the fat, even if you're calorie counting. That's the real devilishness of this. You could be like eating the little snack well, 100 calorie little snacks and portion control, and literally starving yourself every day. But if you're eating a high enough count of carbs and sugar, you're not going to lose any meaningful fat weight whatsoever. You might lose some muscle mass. You might lose some bone density, but you're not going to lose any meaningful amount of fat, because your insulin is still too high and your body will not allow you to burn off that fat, because that fat is actually serves a biological purpose of keeping you from starving to death during the winter when food is scarce. But you can't lose it because your insulin level is too high, which tells your body you're eating carbs, which tells your body, oh, we can't lose this weight right now. We're not eating proper human food, which is beef, butter, bacon, and eggs, meat and eggs, seafood, actually real nutrient-dense foods. We're not eating that. We're eating this little snack well cake that has no meaningful nutrition in it. So we must be in a famine. We're starving to death. We're hungry all the time. I'm not going to get rid of this fat. I'm going to hold on to it because it seems like we need it. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. And some of it is even more than just like a biological choice. It's almost like asking something to burn without oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you have high insulin in your blood, you can't burn. It won't. It just won't do it. Like it can't do it. It's biologically impossible to do it. Or you know, people that like to have an occasional adult beverage, that's fine, but you can't be drinking while you're on a weight loss regimen because your liver has to make it, especially if you're eating sugar, because your liver has to go, okay, I got alcohol and I got fructose. And both of them are poisons. I don't care what anybody tells you. Look it up if you doubt me. But they have to get in line. It can't simultaneously do them. I learned this when I went through this, that if you want to really blow your liver up, drink screwdrivers or cranberry vodkas or something that's high sugar with the alcohol. You can't do both. So since the alcohol will kill you quicker, your body's smart enough to go, okay, alcohol gets in the front of line. And until that happens, all that sugar in your bloodstream, you just gave yourself temporary type 2 diabetes, even if you don't have it.
Absolutely.
And I'm just glad to hear you say that, because I tell people that and they tell me I don't know nothing because I'm a redneck duck farmer and I don't know shit about medicine and I'm not a doctor. Turns out people can read and learn shit without going to college. It's fucking crazy, but you can do it.
And I let me just say, I've been following Jack for over a decade. I was listening to Jack's podcast back when he was in the Jetta. Okay. That's so for any of you guys, and I want anybody who's an old, longtime listener of Jack, you may have missed the episode when he first interviewed me. I want you to go back and find that one. And I want you to listen to the difference in the tune that Jack sings now versus the tune that Jack sung then, because he almost bet me $5,000 and he would have lost his money. But that, I'm not making fun of Jack. What I'm saying is Jack is educable. Jack is curious. Jack is like, who is this redneck from Tennessee doctor telling me that I cannot gain weight if I just eat beef, butter, bacon, and eggs? And then Jack, that encouraged, he's like, I'm going to look that up. I'm going to do some research. That's what any good doctor should do. That's what any good citizen should do. You should go, that flies directly in the face of what I currently think I believe. I need to look that up. I need to do some research. And I have even more respect for Jack now after that, because that's exactly what he's done with every other topic that he's ever talked about on the podcast. And also, he's very common sense. He says, you know, I'm going to help you if times get bad or even if they don't. And I love that dual pathway. That's one of the things that I was like, oh, I like this guy, because that's good, because I don't want to look like this crazy prepper, but I would like to be prepared. And I think that's very wise, to be prepared. Why would I not want to be prepared? I think that's the Boy Scouts talk about that. And so I love Jack's entire philosophy about all this, and that he's willing to say, yep, I was wrong about that, because I've said that many, many times as a doctor as the decades have went by.
I've mocked myself for it. I've had episodes where I like play the music. It was like, dun, dun, dun. Jack was wrong. Like, here's my thing. You can't learn without admitting you were wrong, because you had to be wrong because you didn't know.
Exactly.
Right? So if you can't be wrong, then you've just stated you're incapable of learning, because either you don't want to learn anything, though, or you know everything.
Exactly.
And I've met a lot of smart-ass people in my life that I'm like, wow, this dude is wicked smart. I don't think you ever met him. Steven Reisner on the whole aquaponics, on all the stuff that you can do naturally for plant control and all. I know a lot about that. Nick Ferguson, who knows a lot about that. And I sat on a panel with him, and Nick Ferguson walks up to me at the end of that panel. He goes, do you feel like a freaking imbecile now? And I'm like, yeah, I kind of do. Like, I feel like I don't know anything, because I'm sitting next to this dude. He doesn't know everything about his subject, let alone the whole world. So you have to be willing to accept that you're wrong, or you can't learn. Or you know what you end up doing? Donald Trump comes out and says something like, hey, our latest indications are if you are pregnant, you probably shouldn't use Tylenol unless you absolutely have to. So you make a TikTok video the next day chugging liquid Tylenol and destroying your liver and your baby's liver, because you can't be wrong.
Right. And the parting message I want everybody watching this to understand is, I don't care what your profession is. I don't care what your level of education is. If you're watching this right now, that means that you have a cell phone or a laptop. Right. Or you probably do. You can look up any medical condition. You can look up any symptom. You can look up any of this stuff, and you can educate yourself to the point where you can have a rational, reasonable conversation with a good doctor and you can treat them as a learned health partner and say, yeah, I know you're smarter than me, but I've got a few questions. Please help me understand, or please help me check for this. That is your right to do that. You are capable of doing that. And if you can find a doctor who will work with you, there is hope for you to be able to reverse medical conditions that you may have been told your entire life are chronic and progressive. There's nothing you can do about it except take the pills, take the injections, take the infusions. That might not be true. I want you to leave this conversation today with that little glimmer of hope that maybe type 2 diabetes is reversible. Maybe fatty liver is reversible. Maybe metabolic syndrome. Maybe schizophrenia. Yeah, there's new research out using a ketogenic diet that's blowing the psychiatry experts away, because this person who was institutionalized for over a decade, they're now out living independently. They have a job and they have a boyfriend. That kind of stuff happens when you stop slowly poisoning yourself with the wrong foods or with pseudo foods, which is what I call what big food makes, and they attempt to call it food. When you do that, and then you also know what symptoms to look for, and you know that it's your right to ask your doctor about those symptoms, you're potentially able to extend your lifespan and your health span and enjoy a level of health that you just thought you'd never dream would be possible for you again. All that stuff's possible, but you gotta start honoring your sovereignty as a human and say, no, I'm worthy. I can ask my doctor a question. I can get a second opinion. I can read Common Sense Labs. I can understand that book. And then I can go to my doctor with a list of questions. And if my doctor likes that, I can fire that doctor's ass and find a new doctor. That's my right as a patient.
All right. Let's see if we can lightning round some Q&A here, because you're really great at making sure people fully understand things. But we're at 90 minutes now, and I know you got other things to do. So let's try to keep these about 1 minute each or less.
Okay.
Including if the answer is no, you can just say no, next question. All right.
I will.
All right. So can hypothyroidism be corrected with diet?
Hypothyroidism is easier to control, and you have to take less thyroid replacement hormone when you're eating a proper human diet.
So you could say it can be addressed with, but it probably will need other treatments as well. Okay.
Yes.
Same person says, I was DX diagnosed, I guess he's saying, with idiopathic, word that you can read, Ken.
Sclerosis.
All right. Over 30 years ago, can carnivore keto make it worse?
No, it's going to make it better.
Okay. That's good enough. Darkwing says, are there thyroid supplements you recommend if your doctor won't do more than some medication I can't pronounce?
There are some, but I don't really recommend them. What I recommend you do is find a doctor who will prescribe you natural desiccated thyroid replacement hormone. Here's the trick. If your doctor says, no, I'm only going to give you Synthroid or levothyroxine, which is fake T4, Here's what you do. You call a local pharmacy, not CVS or Walgreens. You call Smith Drugs or Hopkins Apothecary, and you say, hey, who's the local doctor in the area? Could be next county over, I don't care, that prescribes Nature or Armour Thyroid. And the pharmacist will actually get on the phone with you at a locally owned pharmacist, and they'll say, oh, that's Dr. McGillicuddy over in the next county over. You go see Dr. McGillicuddy, and you'll get what you need.
Awesome. All right. Jake says, this is about your book. Audio version coming soon, or is this not audiobook friendly?
It's not really audiobook friendly, but we've had so many people ask for it that we're talking to Victory Belt now. The problem is that the PDF that accompanies the audiobook would be as long as the book itself, because the book is full of charts and tables. But if enough people want that, I'm happy to do it, and I'll read the audible version of it. So maybe is the answer.
Yeah, and the one thing I'll advise you is, you know all those times you get free audiobooks? Yeah, the author doesn't get paid. Ask me how I freaking know. So make that part of your business decision there. Exactly. How important are blood tests if I feel okay?
So if you're 20 and you feel fine, I'm not even going to go with okay. If you're 20 and you're like, dude, I feel great, you don't need any blood tests. You probably don't even need to go to the doctor. If you're 30, same thing applies. If you're 40, now we're starting to get into that gray zone a little bit, because you can feel fine for years and have a problem. So I recommend most people about the age of 40-ish, you need to go and get the full lab panel that we talk about in this book. even if it all turns out normal, that's actually useful information because it verifies that, yes, you are healthy, but it also sets a baseline in black and white so that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, when you get those labs rechecked and they've changed, you can see what it used to be when you were 35 or 40, and you can see what it is now that you're 50 or 55. That's super useful information because a doctor, I can't tell you how many times I've said, God, I wish I knew what your fasting insulin was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But I can't. I don't have a time machine so I can't do that. So I would say about 40-ish, even if you feel amazing, you need to go at least one time and get the full lab panel checked.
And I would add to that, like at 40, let's say you started declining in health at 30 by 1% a year. That's 10% over 10 years. You won't feel it. You That's won't right. know it until you address it. And everybody that's ever done keto carnivore goes, fuck, I didn't know how bad I actually felt till I didn't feel bad anymore. Because it's like when you see your kid every day and by the end of summer, you're like, oh, maybe he got a little taller. And Uncle Bill, who hadn't seen him since, you know, he was there when the school ended, comes back and goes, holy shit, he's done sprung up 6 inches, but you didn't see it. And you can have a negative do the same thing. So
exactly right.
That's something you need to consider. Okay may not be okay. Can someone please say the 5 blood tests again? What are those 5 primary blood tests, Ken?
No, you got to buy the book.
You got to buy the book.
Okay. A1C, fasting insulin, triglycerides, HDL cholesterol, and hsCRP. Now, the full thyroid panel, let me just go ahead and say that as well, is a TSH, a free T4, a free T3, a reverse T3, a TPO antibody, and a TG antibody. 6 tests make up the full thyroid panel. And you guys, I'm not saying them again. You can go back and rewatch that.
Okay, this next one's not a question. I just knew it would make you feel good, so I'm going to let you read it.
Spearco and Dr. Berry are the reason I will live many years longer. And let me say this. This is important because there's Brian Johnson all over social media and other people like him saying, I'm going to live to be 150 years old and I'm taking 45 supplements and I'm doing all these things and I'm eating a plant-based diet. None of that's been proven, guys. All of that is hypothesis, but basically meaning his opinion. Maybe his educated opinion, but I doubt that.
Yeah.
Here's how you live longer. The way to live longer is not to die. That's the only way to fail at living longer, okay? Now, so that seems very common sense. You're kind of like, well, duh, yeah, if you die, you're not living longer, right? But for every day you don't die, you just live longer. Everybody agrees with that. So what is the leading cause of heart attack and stroke in modern society? Is it high cholesterol? Is it high LDL cholesterol? Is it high ApoB? No, it's type 2 diabetes.
Correct.
So reversing type 2 diabetes and then reversing prediabetes back to a normal A1C, that is the number one way to live longer. Because if you don't have type 2 diabetes, your risk of having a heart attack and dying go down precipitously, not just a little bit, a lot. Now, let's say you're severely obese. That increases your risk of dying. Let's say you reverse that with keto or carnivore. Now you're by definition, you've reversed type 2 diabetes and severe obesity. You're by definition going to live longer unless you get hit by a bus, right?
Yeah.
What if you have fatty liver? That will greatly shorten your life. But you reversed it with keto or carnivore. You're demonstrably going to live longer unless lightning strikes you, okay? Every day you roll the dice when you put your feet on the floor. But if you're reversing these things that are known to shorten the human lifespan, how can anybody, any doctor, any dietitian even imply that you're not going to live longer if you reverse your type 2 diabetes? If they imply that, that is ignorance on its face. That's ignorance because what kills you quickly, if you reverse that, obviously you're going to live longer.
Yeah. And I'll also say, like, there's a quality of life issue, too. Let's give you 2 scenarios, Ken. I'm Carnac. Remember Carnac, Johnny Carson days? And I can look into the future and say, at one
way before my time, I don't get that reference.
Yeah, but go ahead. If it's for me, it's for you, too. Anyway, Carnac says, Ken, you have path A. You will live to be 89 years old. The day before you die, you'll take a walk around OB Farms. You'll bounce your great-grandkids on your knee. You will think everything is fine. You will go to bed on the day of your 89th birthday and die in your sleep. Option B, you get to live to be 90. But at 75, you're going to start using a cane. By 80, you're going to be using a walker. Your last 5 years of your life will be spent in an easy chair until the last 6 months of your life where you'll be in an infirmary home, an elder care facility, and then you'll die of pneumonia in that elder care facility at 90. But you'll make one more year. Which path are you walking?
Yeah, I'm going path A every time because I want to be the great-grandfather that's kicking the soccer ball around in the backyard with my great-grandkids. That's who I want to be.
At it, but at least you can do it, right?
Exactly right. They're going to be impressed that I even tried, but I'm absolutely going to be doing that. So Common Sense Labs Trial and Error is available at any bookstore. You can, if they don't have it in stock, they can order it. You can get the Kindle version or the paperback version on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, at all the other bookstores. You can get it anywhere. If they don't have it in stock, they'll happily order it for you.
Now, the only correct answer is when this live stream's over, wait 30 minutes and click the link in the video notes and then go order it off my website from Amazon so I get my 45 cents. No, I don't care what you get. I'm just kidding you. I did want to give you a little bit of a brag here, though, because I looked at the stats when I pulled up that page. This is Ken's book on Amazon on the bestsellers list right now. Number one in medical diagnosis, number one in preventive medicine, number two in doctor-patient relations. I don't know who's number one there, but they're wrong. They shouldn't be there.
It's Common Sense. It's Lies My Doctor Told Me.
Oh, it's his other book, right? So maybe he knows what he's talking about. And overall, I don't remember the exact number. It's like 4,400, like the 4,400th best-selling book on Amazon. Folks, I know this as an author because you look it up when you start seeing yourself hit these lists. Like, well, what does that mean? There's over 55 million book titles, and Ken's book on this kind of obscure thing, medical stuff, is number 4,400 and change. It might be worth picking it up. Let's see here. Ion says, how many meals is good for people with diabetes on ketovore or carnivore diet? I mean, it depends.
One meal a day, two meals a day, or three meals a day. Snacking in between meals is always an emotional event, as my friend Dr. Savis says. If you're having to snack in between meals, that's either an emotional event or you didn't eat enough total food. The beauty of keto and carnivore is, for weight loss and for diabetes and for all the other things we talked about, is you don't have to portion control. You don't have to calorie count. You get to do what every other animal on planet Earth does, which is eat until you're full. And then stop eating. You don't have to push away after you've had so many calories or so many ounces. That's not how any other animal does it. You don't have to do it that way either if you're eating a species-appropriate diet, which is a proper human diet. And I'm working on a book by that title, In Search of a Proper Human Diet. It'll be out within the next 1 to 12 years, depending. I don't know.
I can say 1 to 12 months, 1 to 12 years. Now, I agree with that, but I will tell you this. When you go to a two-meal-a-day plan, you eat less food.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I don't care how much you allow yourself to eat, you eat less food. I had a very unhealthy emotional attachment to food. So when I did this, I looked up all the things I could eat and eat almost until there was no – like, I could eat as much as I wanted. And I went out and bought all these high-end meats and some cheeses and stuff like that, and I threw it all in my refrigerator, and then I went to a two-mad schedule. And like 3 weeks later, I'm looking at all this food going, when the hell am I going to eat this stuff?
Yep.
It was four snacks and all. That's right. You don't need a snack. You don't need a snack. Like, and lions and tigers, true carnivores, they generally eat about once a day because they have to like go kill something.
Yep.
Right. Or a leopard will eat, it'll kill something. It'll drag its ass up in a tree and it'll eat a big filling of it and it'll leave it there and come back once a day because it doesn't want anything to find it. And we were never running down animals and biting them in the neck. That's not what we were. We're much higher level beings, but we pretty much killed shit to eat it until not that long ago, right?
Like 100%.
10,000 years is what they say for modern agriculture. Bro, what Egypt was doing 8,000 years ago didn't look like anything we're doing now. And still, that was post-settlement. There was plenty of places where people were still living like they were 50,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 500 years ago. And
absolutely,
you can't find an indigenous society that's not killing shit to eat it. It doesn't exist. I'm sure you're familiar with Dr. Price. And I didn't know this. I recently had some stuff I did with the what's the name Price Foundation or Price Pottinger, actually, which is the real one. And they told me, and I did not know this, Ken. I don't know if you knew this. Dr. Price was actually very disappointed.
Yes.
That he never found a vegan or vegetarian indigenous society because he began his quest with the belief that that was the way to eat. And his quest was so true to true science that he disproved his own hypothesis. That's a scientist.
And he was actually a dentist, but that's exactly right. He thought a plant-based diet was the whatever proper human diet. And so when he actually started studying all these indigenous cultures, and he went everywhere from the northernmost mountains down to the southernmost jungles, he's like, no, all these people eat meat all the time, eggs all the time. They eat all the animal fat. And yes, they ate plants, but they always ate the meat and they always ate the fat that came with the meat. In many cases, they would prioritize organs or prioritize a certain kind of fat. And that's a proper human diet. Absolutely right. But he's a great example of what a good doctor is because he had a preconceived notion. He had a paradigm. He's like, I know this is right. I'm just going to go prove it. And the evidence was like slapped him right in the face. He's like, actually, no, you're totally wrong. And he admitted it and he learned from it. That's what every doctor should do.
I don't know if you ever read any of the stuff from like Peter Capstick, Robert Rourke, Teddy Roosevelt on hunting in Africa. But do you know what the most sought job on a safari party was for, like, if you were like an African boy that wanted to get your job on a safari?
What was it?
Skinner. The Skinner. Because the Skinner got to pull out the kidney fat, right? And the caul fat and all that, because on game, there's not as much. Big game, there is quite a bit of fat, actually. But like your gazelles, your antelopes and all that, your smaller animals, it's very little fat. But inside that animal is that caul fat. And they all have it. And so if you were the skinner, you were skinning, you were gutting, you got the fat because no one cared that you took the fat because the Mensab and the Bwanawa Safari, they wanted the loin cooked over the fire and they knew most of it went to the party anyway. They wanted the trophies, but the person that lived there, the native who lived like a native still, knew that fat was and like the kidneys and the liver, that was the most valuable thing to them. And since it was throwaway stuff, if you were the skinner, you got first dibs.
Nice, nice. That every ancestral society prized the fat and prized the organs. This is well documented in the anthropological literature. Anybody who doubts it, look it up. Be happy to be proven wrong, because I promise you, when you start eating a proper human diet, your health will improve.
And anything they ate that wasn't from an animal, that was like the biggest mainstay, was always fermented.
Yep.
It was always lacto fermented.
Always soaked, always cooked to death, always fermented. That's how humans have always done plant foods. That's how they've always done dairy as well. But if they're eating it as an adult, they always fermented it or they did something else to it to make it less inflammatory. And you're absolutely right. And I hope that our conversation today has encouraged a lot of people to say, that can't be true. I hope somebody's disagreeing with us.
Please.
I want you to look into it. Do your research. Prove me wrong. I'm happy to be proven wrong, because when I'm proven wrong, I'm very happy, because that means I just learned something new. And I love to learn new stuff.
Yeah, go show us the seven country study that was done where the meat eaters were also not high carb. Go find that study.
Exactly.
You can't. I've got a standing bet for $1,000. Anybody can show it to me. I get an email about once a month about how they're going to do it, and then I never hear from them again. It's funny as shit. Okay, one more, and we'll set you free to go work on your books and do your other stuff and what have you. Elski says, can you please advise me on the carnivore diet for someone that has celiac?
Yeah. So if you'll adopt a strict carnivore diet, it can be as simple as beef, butter, bacon, and eggs. You will put your celiac disease in complete remission. It'll be like you don't have it anymore. This also applies to ulcerative colitis and irritable bowel disease. All three of these are one of the reasons that very young, very healthy looking people are very strict about their carnivore diet, is because these kind of gastrointestinal diseases go completely away when you remove the inflammatory plant phytochemicals from your diet.
is there any disease? Because I get this all the time from doctors, nurses, NPs, but this person has XYZ syndrome and they can't. Is there anything that actually you shouldn't eat a animal-based diet? Is there any disease?
So there's about 20 different inborn errors of genetic metabolism diseases. Now, if anybody watching this, here's how to know if you have one of those. Have you ever been to a pediatric geneticist as a child?
Okay.
Were you ever in the pediatric intensive care unit? Have you ever seen a pediatric endocrinologist? If your answer to those three questions are, I don't even know what that is, you don't have one of those diseases. I was going to make a YouTube video about who shouldn't eat keto or carnivore, but it turns out it's about 4,000 people in the entire United States.
Okay.
And they're well aware I have this inborn error of protein or fat metabolism. I have to eat this very special diet or I'll get sick because I can't process the fat or protein that comes in a proper human diet because I have a genetic defect. These people are well aware of that, and okay, they know not to eat those things.
If it was you, you would know it. All right, real quick here, folks. If you want more of Dr. Ken Berry and you want to see him face-to-face, get your butt to Camden, Tennessee, October 4 through 5 at the Self-Reliance Festival. And you can see he's one of the headliners there of the presenters. Thank you to Angie who reminded me to do that before we wrapped up.
Thank you. I'm glad you did that.
Yeah, thank you, Ken, for being today. Again, Common Sense Labs is the book. If you go to Amazon and just search for it, you will find it. It will pop up right away because it is on multiple bestsellers lists. Congrats on that, Ken.
Thank you.
If you guys want to, if you're watching live now or you're seeing this later, there's a link in the video notes right down there, and that will go over to the audio side. I'll have all of Ken's reference material. You can follow him on social media, hook up with him. Those books, all of it will be there. So if you're driving in a car, listening to this or whatever, you don't have to pull over and write it down. Just look up the episode 3737, easy to remember, and you'll be able to get all that information. And Ken, thank you for being with us today. Everybody that tuned in, thanks for tuning in today as well. And that audio version, sans any problems from StreamYard that I've been having this week, will be live in about 30 minutes. Ken, thank you for being with us. You got anything else to say before I let everybody go?
It's always a pleasure to hang out with you, Jack, and talk the truth. I want everybody to eat your meat, okay? Shut up and eat your meat. That's literally all you have to understand about human nutrition.
Just run you around. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.